the Queensland election, the US election, and Victoria moves towards COVID normal. This is The Week on Wednesday. Hello and welcome to The Week on Wednesday. I am your host, Ben Davison, and this is a very special Thursday edition of The Week on Wednesday.
Because I was sick.
Fanny was a bit unwell, but all is well now. Everything is working fine, and here we are. I am joined, of course, by the lovely, the talented, the magnificently healthy Van Badham. How are you, Van?
I'm feeling a lot better, Benny. Thank you.
That's good. That's good. So thanks for sticking with us, folks. We are very excited by how many people are downloading each and every episode.
Yes, we genuinely get very surprised. It's like, oh, people are listening to us.
And it continues to grow. So we owe a great debt of thanks to everyone who's sharing, who's talking up the show, and all the people who have written in as well. We really appreciate that. We've had some lovely emails of support over the last few weeks.
And remember, if there are things you'd like us to talk about, send us an email and we'll do our best.
Absolutely. So this week we're going to be talking about the Queensland state election, Clive Palmer's private jet, and of course the same old death tax lie.
Oh my God, when will it end?
Saturday.
Saturday. Brilliant. Ben, how is the Queensland election going?
Well, it's been a really, really interesting election insofar as at the start of the year before COVID, there was quite a sense that Labor was likely to lose this election. The polling looked like the LNP was ahead. It looked like there was a resurgent One Nation vote and that it would be very, very difficult for Anastasia Palaszczuk and the Queensland Labor Party to hold on. Of course, COVID has turned things upside down, as it has with many things. But on top of that, Labor has run a really strong campaign and has really focused on its record and what it's delivered and put a bit of focus on what the LNP has said it will do and what it's hiding from people as well.
Yeah, because the LNP are making a big song and dance about delivering surpluses or cutting budgets or whatever, which is what they always go on with. We know that. Yeah. And of course, some clever clogs did the maths and realised that this would result in tens of thousands of job losses. And of course, the deep scar in Queensland is the short but very imperiled reign of one Campbell Newman from the LNP was of like mass sackings across the Queensland Public Service. They closed sexual health clinics in Queensland.
14,000 healthcare workers were sacked. He was only in power for less than 4 years.
And this was the thing. It was a short reign, and yet the damage done to the Queensland economy in that time was just extraordinary. And of course, Labor have been right to point out that the things that the Liberals have promised come with a cost, and that cost is usually, a household breadwinner. So maybe not a brilliant idea to re-elect the LNP. It really does my head in because the policy cupboard is so bare. And when we talk about the American election, there are one or two things that I'd like to talk about the relative economic politics of the two major parties. Because, of course, in Australia, we have the Labor group, we have the Liberal National group, the Coalition, the LNP, all the different brands they call themselves in order to hide the fact that they are the same Tory scumbags they've always been. And there's an economic orthodoxy around the Conservative movement, whether it's the Republicans in America, the Tories in Britain, or the Tories here, about cuts and this whole, obsession with budget balancing, which is, of course, never true and never happens. And, at the end of the day, it does result in people losing their jobs.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it is a really clearly rejected at the ACT election, which of course was a couple of weeks ago, where the Liberal Party there, that's the brand they run under in the ACT, promised better services and lower taxes and no job cuts and a balanced budget. And at the ACT, of course, you've got a very high level of education. You've got a lot of people who actually work in policy who just went, this is magic pudding stuff. Like you can't employ more people, but reduce cost and tax less. It just doesn't make sense. I think the messages that are coming out in Queensland, obviously Queensland is a very decentralised population up along the coast. You've got 3 seats in Townsville. They're a big focus for the LNP. And the strategies around how these messages are delivered and where they're delivered and who they're delivered to are going to be absolutely critical to who actually wins. It is really close. People shouldn't be under the impression that, oh, Anastasia Palaszczuk has got some kind of thumping majority. She's only got a majority of two or three seats at the moment, and it is going to be a really close election. Having said that, the last debate was on last night, and Palaszczuk won 53-30.
Yes, apparently it was quite a thumping performance, and Deb Frecklington was sort of standing there, not so much not holding the baby, but not really knowing where the baby was. So.
And, of course, this time around, like we did in the 2019 federal election, we have the spoiler factor that is Clive Palmer.
Oh, he is. He's the literal embodiment of spoiler, really, isn't he, our Clive?
One of my
favourite people in politics. Oh, no, sorry. One of my least favourite people in politics anywhere ever. An absolutely monstrous human being in all ways.
Absolutely monstrous.
I should clarify this. As everybody who listens to this show knows, amongst my many obsessions is, of course, American politics and particularly American campaigning, which I study very closely. It's one of my great fascinations. So you can imagine during the last federal election what it was like to be me and to have my knowledge of American politics and discover that there was this internet campaign that was running claiming that if the Australian Labor Party were elected, they were going to sneakily introduce a 40% death tax on everything everybody owned. And I saw Facebook posts coming from, you know, ordinary people, conspicuously with names like Kyler and Trevor, and ordinary people were saying, this is how it works, the death tax. You know, you might inherit a $16,000 car from your dad, and then the government will come because your dad's dead and make you pay $4,000 because that's, you know, 40% of, or that's 25%. But anyway, I can maths better. I haven't been well.
The numbers in most of the memes were not
accurate. The numbers in most of the memes, but I was like, 40%, wait a second, I've seen this before. And of course, I remembered that in the 2017, the lead up to the congressional elections in 2018, in the lead up to that in 2017, there was, of course, a death tax campaign that was run in the United States that used the exact same text. So this whole, because they do have death taxes in the United States of America on estates of more than $5.8 million. Yeah. Like, it's literally a tax on rich people, something which, spoiler alert, I'm a huge fan of. I think there should be more taxes on rich people, especially rich dead people, because I don't really buy the entrepreneur, pull yourself up by the bootstraps, you know, self-made man slash woman mythology when people inherit billions of dollars. Like, I think if it's a level playing field, let's level that playing field.
And we should be really clear about why estate taxes exist in places like the UK, the US, parts of Europe.
To stop aristocracies from forming.
Absolutely. And in Australia, we had one for a long time as well, because we had the squatocracy. And so there was an estate tax brought in to prevent the rise of an aristocracy.
Of people who came to this country and committed a genocide and stole land. Yes. And then passing on those gains to their children without any accountability whatsoever.
That does seem to be the definition of aristocracy.
Well, but this is the thing about Clive Palmer. So in the federal election, like, it became very clear that this death tax mythology, and it was a complete mythology, Labor had no such plan at all. Mm. Like, Labor were very upfront. And by the way, taking enormous amounts of heat for tax policies, they did actually announce well in advance of the election. So the idea that people fell for this sort of death tax scare actually had to do with what we're seeing around some very sophisticated disinformation techniques. Disinformation techniques learned from places like the Internet Research Agency, which is, of course, a Russian government front, and various other, like, professional disinformation businesses that have sprung up around the world. And the way that these disinformation campaigns work is that they take something that is not true, but it's seeded through social media. So ordinary people like Trevor and Kayla, who are probably real people, believe it and then become agitated and share this information themselves. So people see it as coming from ordinary people who are traceable and whatever, and give it a credence that they ordinarily wouldn't get. And I just find it amazing that, I mean, Clive, what I find really funny is Clive is sort of notoriously tight with his cash. Just ask anybody who used to work for him in Townsville who was laid off without their entitlements. And, of course, I don't think he's wanted to pay whoever he paid last time for various campaign apparatuses on the internet. Yeah. So he's just repeating the old campaign and hoping it'll stick.
Well, at the moment, his companies have spent $4.7 million, and there's so much wrong with this concept, right? So Mineralogy is the kind of big Clive Palmer company, and Mineralogy owns Clive's private jets. And this came out this week as well, but the Morrison government, when the pandemic hit, set up an aviation rescue package, in inverted commas, which of course didn't rescue Virgin, has not helped 5,000 Qantas workers. Has
totally abandoned the Donata employees.
Totally abandoned them. But this rescue package, part of it has gone to the owners of private jets, including Mineralogy, which is owned by Clive Palmer, to the tune of about $40,000. And Mineralogy has donated far in excess of that to Clive's political party in the Queensland election. So you've got this pretty clear line between Commonwealth funding, taxpayer money.
From a Liberal National government.
From a Liberal National
government.
Because
they call themselves the Liberal National Coalition at a federal level, as opposed to the LNP or the Just Liberal.
That has then flowed directly into a campaign that's purely about attacking Labor. None of the polls suggest that Clive Palmer's party has really any chance of winning any seats. But what it can do is break votes off and redirect preferences away from Labor MPs. And that's really the strategy that's being played out with Clive Palmer, certainly with the LNP. I mean, they're attacking Jackie Trad, saying put Jackie Trad last. You're seeing a whole range of these small parties doing exactly the same thing. And it's going to be difficult. That's why it's going to be difficult. So even though the kind of headline polls
Well, I mean, it's also an air war, isn't it? I mean, that was one of the things about the last federal election that people outside of Queensland didn't see, just the level of saturation advertising paid for by Palmer up in Queensland. I mean, we saw versions of it here in Victoria and elsewhere with his Make Australia Great Again, because he is, of course, nothing except derivative. But certainly what having the platform of a campaign allows him to do is just like mercilessly attack the Labor Party.
Yeah.
And of course, Clive has no relationship to the truth. There are no laws in Australia that govern truth in political advertising. You can, you know, you can accuse everybody of being a lizard person. And I'm quite sure those political actors are probably somewhere on the scene in Queensland, as we know they are in Victoria. You can accuse people of being a lizard person, and there's no redress for that.
I find it interesting you say he's nothing if not derivative. You know, he's currently engaged in a lawsuit with Twisted Sister over We're Not Going to Take It. And he gave testimony, I think, towards the end of last week. He was called upon to give testimony, and he suggested that he had made up his version, which is essentially, you know, a complete rip-off. And Twisted Sister have said, you've just ripped off our song. And he has fought this tooth and nail, and he's claimed to be a poet and that he's published many, many pieces of poetry. And of course, the lawyer said, you do realise you're under oath. This is not a political interview. You can't just say whatever you like. He said, oh, yes, I understand that. I understand that.
It's one of the great dreams I have, that we will one day see Clive Palmer in jail. That's a dream that I have. Because after what he did to those workers in Townsville, who were the employees of the
Queensland Nickel,
where they were totally abandoned, left in it, like, Townsville has a shocking unemployment problem, absolutely shocking. And, you know, youth unemployment is something like 20%, and it's been a problem for a long time. And to turn around to those workers and their families and go, oh, we've got no money, sorry, and then bankroll this multi-million-dollar election campaign. It's just
two multi-million dollar election.
It's so insulting.
And a high court challenge against WA.
It's insulting, and it's an attack on working people. And Clive, I've got your number, buddy. I'm never going to stop. Never, ever going to stop following you around.
So Clive Palmer is up to his neck up in the Queensland election. This Saturday is election day. You can probably hear our dog barking. It looks like over half the ballots will already have been cast come Saturday because of pre-poll and postals. So we may not have a result on Saturday. That's okay. The democratic process needs to play out and every vote should be counted. But on that topic, let's move now to the other big election that's coming up next week. That is the US election. Less than a week to go, Van.
Less than a week to go, literally. I think that's why I was ill yesterday. It's the overwhelming anxiety of there being less than a week to go, and yet it also feels like it's 8 years away, this election. It is just crazy. It has not stopped being crazy. We, of course, had the amazing event of the appointment of Justice Amy Coney Barrett, who we've discussed before, a woman who used to let herself be referred to as a handmaid in a religious organisation when she was living with something that, I mean, legally I don't know if I would describe it as a cult. I'll let you make up your own minds there. But certainly a person who is on record campaigning against abortion rights, campaigning against environmental rights and all kinds of things. She was appointed. The Republicans who refused to appoint the Obama nomination Merrick Garland, because it was like more than 200 days out from an election in election year, appointed her 8 days before the US election, cementing a 6-3 conservative majority on the Supreme Court. And they were delighted with themselves. It was a vote that fell entirely down party lines. People like Mitt Romney, who, you know, goes to the occasional Black Lives Matter rally, did not distinguish himself with any bravery. He voted for Amy. And, of course, the argument is that this is all about trying to stem a demographic tide in America through the most illegitimate means possible. Because what we know about the United States of America is that the times of, like, majority white demographics are ending. And you're seeing really large, diverse communities of people with different attitudes, different cultural upbringings to the good old boys and, you know, might is right. And the Republicans have been aware of this for a really long time. And rather than embrace the diversity of America, they've, of course, decided to buckle down and just try and they're a bit like, is it Xerxes or Darius who whips the river, who wants the Hellespont to behave in a different way? That's not going to happen. But they use tactics like voter suppression, where particularly in majority black communities, you'll get like one ballot box to thousands and thousands and thousands of people, redistricting, which is, of course, like, if you want to have a terrified laugh about how America is not really a democracy, look up electoral maps in the United States. And rather than in Australia, where everybody's sort of proportioned out, so every seat has about the same number of electors and they cross all these different areas, in America, they tend to, Republican administrations tend to pack all of the Democrats into electorates to the shape of snakes and lollipops and bits over here. And so you concentrate all your Democrat voters and then you edge yourself to have Republican majorities by stealth in other weird-looking seats. And obviously striking people off electoral rolls. There's a really high incarceration rate of black American men because of structural racism. We all know that that's a thing. And, of course, jurisdiction by jurisdiction, you lose your voting rights if you have a criminal record. And this is what they've done. And cementing a majority on the Supreme Court is all about making sure no one has the right to complain.
And I found this really interesting. I looked this up yesterday because in America, the Supreme Court appointments are for life. So in Australia yesterday, Morrison and Porter announced two High Court appointees.
Oh, who happen to be conservatives. Well, what a coincidence.
Yeah, one of them less conservative than the other. But they've been announced because there's a 70-year compulsory retirement age for Australian Supreme High Court justices. Whereas in America, it is an appointment for life. Now, in 1800, appointment for life basically meant that you served 20 years, right? Like you were dead. You were dead within 20 years. Now, that number has blown out to over 35 years. So this whole concept, and you're exactly right, what they're doing is Amy Coney Barrett will probably serve 40 years. You know, her, given her age, she could easily serve 35 to 40 years. And it's this...
without any process of recall.
Yeah.
You and I were talking earlier about Nancy Pelosi, who I just think is an extraordinary badass. Like, I'm not going to lie, I just think she's amazing. I'm sure she and I have great political disagreements in some areas, but I just think as a player, she's matchless. Nancy Pelosi is 80 years old, but Nancy is also recallable to the electorate. Like, to hold her position, she's got to get elected in her congressional district, and she's got to be appointed by the Democrats, and there are checks and balances on that process. Supreme Court, no.
Appointment for life. Well, that's obviously one of the big issues that's influencing people, because at the moment, 75.2 million Americans have already voted, and that's 55% of the total number of votes that were cast in 2016. So it does look like there's going to be a bigger turnout. That's what they're predicting. And it's I'm just going to give you some numbers here, because obviously the national polls are very much favouring Biden. But of course, in America, with their system where you've got to win electoral college votes. And
so you have to win your state. You've got to win a majority of votes in a state.
Yeah.
And then you get a proportionalised group of electoral college votes.
Well, you get in every state except for two, you get all of the electoral college votes for that state. And you've got to get to 270 electoral college votes is the win. So in a way, like Hillary Clinton won the total number of votes.
She won by more than 3 million votes as the population of Uruguay, yes.
But it doesn't matter, because you've got to win them in the right spots. And she didn't, and so she lost. So what's important is, where are these votes for Biden happening? And the latest polls, the latest average of polls that I got from The Guardian this morning, that Biden leads by 1% in Florida, 5.3% in Pennsylvania, 7.3% in Michigan, 2.2% in North Carolina, 3.6% in Arizona, 6.7% in Wisconsin, and 0.3% in Iowa, whereas Trump only leads in Ohio by 1.8. So if that were to replicate itself, and there are obviously states like New York and California, which are Democrat voting, traditionally large numbers of Democrat votes.
Yeah, there is no chance of Trump winning New York or California.
That's Mississippi not gonna happen, which is probably not going to go to Biden.
Probably not. Though, interestingly, Georgia, which has been reliably Republican for a very long time, is now considered a toss-up, and Biden is going to Georgia. And Texas, which is supposed to be the great American Republican stronghold, it was classified today with a polling average as being toss-up. So Kamala Harris is going to Texas. And Texas and Georgia are both what I'm talking about this demographic change in America, where Georgia, particularly in the last election, there was a lot of discussion about voter suppression, and that's how you saw the rise of Stacey Abrams, who was an advocate for voting rights and for enfranchisement. And Georgia has very large Black American population, which has been systemically
suppressed.
Yeah, suppressed. Texas is interesting because, you know, there's a fantasy of Texas, which is Texas is full of white people who wear cowboy hats and, you know, and it's very much
the cowboy state.
Yeah, it's the cowboy state, and it's sort of built into a very white mythology of what America is. Well, that's not what Texas has been like for a long time. And of course, you have really large Black populations in Texas and huge Latino populations in Texas as well. One of the amazing videos that was released this week was a Blacks and Latinos for Biden horse parade in Texas, where all of these Black and Latino cowboys rode their horses to the polling booth with all these Biden flags.
Right.
And it was amazing. It was the most American thing I've ever seen. It was all these dudes on horseback with their 10-gallon hats on, going yee-haw, waving Biden flags to get to the ballot boxes. It was beautiful. But obviously, you know, it's an interesting time. I, of course, as you remember, cried on the floor for some hours after Hillary lost the last election, and that was not a good day for, I think, all of us. So all of my faith in polls and predictions, I don't like to predict elections because, as you know, I hate being wrong.
Yeah.
And certainly the numbers suggest things are positive for Biden. Some things which are interesting, one, we know that there's still some of the polls that we're getting are still margin of error. What would you give a good margin of error as? You're the poll man.
Well, three points. If the margin of error is plus or minus three, then that's pretty good. And of course, most of the polls you'll find, somebody leads inside that, 2.5, or they lead by three, or they lead by 3.2. At which point you go, well, actually, it could still be a toss-up because the error could actually skew it the other way.
Yeah, and one of the things the Trump campaign is counting on is that the polls did get it. Well, the polls were actually pretty close. close last time. Like, if you factor in a margin of error, the last set of American polls were very, very close to predicting the result because it was so tight. I mean, Trump only won by a couple of thousand votes. You know, like Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania got him over the line, really.
And the good thing, I guess, for the Biden camp and the Democrats, when it comes to places like Pennsylvania, he's up 5.3.
Because he's from there.
Michigan, he's up 7.3. You know, Wisconsin, he's up 6.7. Now, those are outside the margin of error. And even if the whole error goes against him, you would think that he's up. And I suppose the other element that's different this time to 2016 is that the polls were a little less consistent last time. Mm. There was a bit more fluctuation and a bit more late movement. And that, of course, when there's instability, then it's harder to make predictions. But this time there's been a lot more consistency in terms of where Biden sits and where Trump sits. And that this breaks down to a state-by-state level as well. Mm. And those states that are close, the Floridas, the Texases, they've remained close throughout. So those states probably are a genuine toss-up, and it's probably very difficult to know how that will go.
Well, there are interesting polling groups like Cook Report. Oh, I nerd out on this stuff so badly, as you know. Like, who have a number of districts which they see as being representative of state. So if you're a professional pollster, you don't give your polling away. You tend to ask parties to pay you for it.
Yeah, of course.
And they use a lot of district level polling. So they might find a town which they know is sort of bellwether for the whole state based on its demographic factors and who voted where, when, and whatever. And the word coming out from people sort of in the know is that it's looking good for Biden. Mm. It's looking good. What the Trump campaign is claiming is that there are shy Trump voters, that there are people who really want to vote Trump but wouldn't tell anyone. And, you know, that might have carried water in 2016, where you had a lot of people who were really pissed off Bernie supporters, for example. And we're not talking bazillions of people, but we're talking enough in the American system to be electorally significant, who wanted to punish Hillary for being Hillary and might have, you know, spitefully voted for Trump. And that, yes, that could have made a difference in some places. But Trump has now been president for 4 years. Given the fact that he has emboldened people to be publicly racist and, you know, pick up guns and go to riots and things like that and chant, lock her up, about Gretchen Whitmer, the governor of Michigan, who just survived a kidnapping attempt.
And kill people with their cars.
And kill people with their cars and things like that. Like, given the fact that there's been, you know, there's no penalty on wearing a MAGA hat, even though people associated with that movement have killed people. Mm. I don't necessarily think that the shy Trump voter is a thing.
No.
I think the shy Biden voter is a thing because you have a lot of Republicans who are the kind of Republicans who I see as part of that, you know, that American spectrum of democracy, like guys who are committed, and I say guys because it's pretty mostly masculinist paradigm, guys who are usually military and have that sense of honor and duty and the Constitution and stuff like that, and, you know, come from culturally Republican communities. And some of these places I've been to, like places like Kennebunkport with the Bush families from in Maine and stuff, you know, I mean, you're a Republican if you're from there. I think that, you know, I see a lot of the stuff on the internet with them talking about people like General Michael Hayden, who's the former head of the CIA, who's like a diehard Republican, who's like, I will not vote for Trump. I will not do it. And a consistent sort of parade of people like that. I think you'll find that there are probably a lot more shy Biden voters than there are Trump ones.
Well, that's what we're seeing, isn't it? We're seeing, you know, like the Lincoln Project. We're seeing Republicans for Biden. We're seeing Republicans against Trump. We're seeing this whole cavalcade of, I guess, non-shy not even always pro-Biden, but anti-Trump conservatives who go, Trump's not a conservative. We need to get rid of him. If he gets another 4 years, conservatism will become whatever this Trumpism actually is. It'll be so toxic to our political conversation. So they're sort of banking on Biden to reestablish a bit of cultural norm so that then America can recover from what Trump has essentially inflicted on it.
Well, I mean, I think they're looking for a political conversation because this is the thing, you know, constitutional deference. These are politically important in America. Mm. Like, and one of the essays that had a really profound effect on me recently was talking about when countries fall to authoritarianism and fascism is when their centre-right becomes weak. Mm. It's actually really important to have a strong centre-right that's willing to speak to a centre-left. Mm. Mm. So you can have outcomes that are negotiated and majoritarian and inclusive, and means that when you make progressive change, it sticks. And one of the things that I think is really interesting in this election is watching the Never Trumpers go from bad, like Orange Man bad, which is a T-shirt you can buy, to saying, actually, the Affordable Care Act's really good. Actually, we need to do something about childcare. And these previous sort of neocon orthodoxies about economics and welfare, they're actually starting to crumble as they look at the absolute dumpster fire America has turned into and going, yeah, maybe a bit of economic equality is important.
I tell you what, it also, I think, provides a good argument for preferential voting.
I love preferential voting.
Doesn't it? It's because, you know, you get negotiated outcomes.
Yeah, whether you like them or not.
Whether you like them or not. That's right. I didn't get my first choice or my second choice, but I did get my third choice, who I don't hate as much as my fourth.
Yeah, yeah. It was when Howard was Prime Minister, I used to say, you know, it's a terrible thing to know that I can't stand that man, but majority of Australians voted for him, you know, which is
Or at least don't hate him as much as I do.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. So, the good news, because those two stories, pretty heavy, elections changed the face of nations, states, people's lives.
Yeah, people's lives.
But something else that's happened.
People's lives. People's lives.
Something else that's happened that's changing people's lives for the better.
Is it the billboards in Times Square that the Lincoln Project put up of Jared and Ivanka?
People should Google those. We don't have time to go into those today ourselves. But do look up Lincoln Project Times Square billboards.
Jared and Ivanka.
Because that will give
you
an absolute chuckle. But Victoria's moving to COVID normal.
Oh, it's the best, isn't it?
It is. And people are so excited. People were lining up outside a steakhouse in Paran at midnight because that's when the restrictions or the protections officially ended. I can't imagine going to a steakhouse and lining up for a steak at 1 in the morning.
This is a total lie. I have seen you desperate for a burger at 1 o'clock in the morning. You wouldn't even line up. You just like, you know,
Push in. That's not true, folks.
That is true. It is completely true.
And it's
you should see him when he goes into like a KFC rage, like must have KFC, must have.
Wow, probably really getting an insight into our lives together here.
Our lives together are wonderful and everybody knows it. So yeah, it's so good. I just love seeing on Facebook all of the friends of mine who are in the inner city who are back. They're back.
In the cafes,
taking photos of themselves going, oh my God, and we met up with people and we had a conversation. Here's a photo of a coffee. And how wonderful that these sort of iconic Melbourne moments, like there's nothing more iconically Melbourne than meeting for a coffee.
That's true.
And it's back.
Well, it is back. And look, people do need to still take care. You know, COVID still exists. It's still real. We still need to wear masks. Kmart has taken the let's be careful to a whole nother level. People are so desperate to go to Kmart that Kmart have instituted an online booking system.
I love it.
So you can go to Kmart for 20 minutes. I remember at uni, we used to go to the 24-hour Kmart at any old hour of the night just to kill time. But you won't be doing that. You need to book ahead to go to Kmart. And, of course, cafes are back. We're seeing people lining up for restaurants.
Markets.
I tried to book a haircut. I am going to get a haircut, folks, but it's not going to happen until the 14th of November. People are desperate to get out of the house. And, look, well done to Victorians because it has been an incredible thing. And, you know, this constant attacks on Victoria from the coalition, the Morrison government, Josh Frydenberg's rants have been just outrageous.
They have been really cruel to Victorians.
When you think about the sacrifices Victoria has made and the achievement, the outcome, you look overseas and I know, overseas is different. Yes, it is. Overseas is different and it's worse and it's terrible and they can't get it under control. Germany has just moved to Victorian style restrictions. France has just gone into a total lockdown. Mm. America is just letting people die for whatever political benefit they seem to think that will.
According to Trump, that COVID is all a media hoax and will go away when the election's over. By the way,
total crazy nonsense. New
medical information today, they appear to have a study and they're going to investigate further, but a study tends to indicate, we know that COVID affects the brain. They think that COVID said, ages your brain by 10 years. Like it progresses the decline of your brain. That's if you survive.
The good news, this is the good news section, is that we have it much, much more under control in Victoria than it was. And it's much, much more under control in Victoria than just about anywhere else.
Less infections today in Victoria than there were in New South Wales. And also, we were congratulated by, I don't know if you know this, Anthony Fauci, who is, of course, the head of the Centre for Disease Control in the United States, who is the bête noire of Donald Trump, keeps desperately urging Americans to do things that will, I don't know, save their own lives. He came out and said, what you've done in Victoria is amazing. Like, this is best practice. This is incredible.
So well done to every Victorian. Well done to every Australian who supported every Victorian. Not you, Scott Morrison and Josh Frydenberg.
Yeah, not you, Josh Frydenberg, in particular. Your speech the other day attacking this whole horrible thing we've lived through was deplorable.
I know lots of people have felt under a huge amount of pressure, and it's been very, very difficult. But you've made it through, and we've made it through with relatively little loss of life and relatively little serious illness. And that is something to be massively proud of. And it gives me hope, and I'm sure it gives you hope too, Vanny, that Victoria will recover economically in the same spirit. And that spirit is one that takes us all forward and lifts us all up and doesn't sacrifice any of us for the sake of a few people.
Short-term pain, long-term gain, I'm all over it. I love a long plan. You know I love a long plan.
And that's the week on Wednesday, this Thursday.
Sorry, everyone. Sorry.
Love you, Vanny.
I love you, Benny.
Bye.